the police. Who knows he's your main guy in this choo-choo train killing? Not a soul. No one. Well, hardly anyone. Can you keep it quiet as long as possible? Amp asked. I don't like press conferences. Actually, I don't believe in press conferences. We run a tight ship around here. No leaks. That's good to hear. I've got 50 other friends that are thinking of giving to your re-election committee. As before, these would be names collected at a soup kitchen near the Staples Center. Amp's assistant would arrange for the cutting of all the cashier's checks drawn from a special company bank account.
I'd be real grateful for the help, said the sheriff. Just a reminder, the max is $1,000 per customer. I remember.
Amp was no longer in a panic to get Buck Nance back on the Cock Farm. The first episode of Bayou Brethren, completed after his disappearance, had absolutely killed in the ratings. It had been written as a somber family discussion of Buck's recently fabricated struggle with booze and pills, setting the stage for his eventual return from fake rehab. During the taping, however, each of the brothers wandered off script to share unflattering anecdotes meant to document Buck's disintegration and also sabotage his popularity with viewers. Crystal Nance had chimed in with an uncharacteristic tirade, having received revelatory correspondence, with photos attached, from a woman claiming to be Buck's secret mistress. Despite around-the-clock supervision, Miracle had somehow gained access to a laptop, and also to Crystal's personal email. As a result, the crying coach, hired for Crystal, faced an impossible task and was sent back to L.A. The success of the Buckless Brethren thrilled Poe, the director. He persuaded the producers to accelerate the season's shooting schedule to 2 episodes per week and shave the editing time by half. The mission: exploit the domestic turbulence among the Nances to lure an even larger audience. Amp had been informed via conference call that Buck's phony rehab period should be extended until further notice. His presence in Pensacola was unneeded. Amp wasn't sure if it would help or hurt the show if Buck was jailed for attacking an innocent Muslim. The malicious internet chatter had mostly abated since YouTube had pulled the videos of Buck's bar monologue in Key West, but floating somewhere around cyberspace was another incendiary clip from a stridently anti-Islamic sermon that he delivered at the fake church. Amp had told no one in the Nance family or on the Brethren production team that Buck was now a murder suspect. So far, the only ones who knew were Amp, Lane Kuhlman, and a high-powered Malibu defense lawyer. And, once more, Kuhlman had fallen off the planet. He hadn't been heard from since he'd left the voicemail on the night of the Conch train killing 2 weeks earlier. It made Amp wonder if his protege was wigging out because of the divorce. Kuhlman's first kidnap story had seemed shaky. Maybe he'd made up the whole thing. Maybe he'd needed the ransom to cover his legal fees. Had Amp owned a fully formed conscience, he would have experienced at least a tickle of guilt for boning Rachel Kuhlman on the sly, but he'd lost not a minute of sleep. It had been her idea, after all, and Amp was but one of many to meet her for a quick one at the Wilshire. That she would pauperize her future ex-husband in court was a given. It was California, right? And hadn't Kuhlman, a scheming hound himself, put the moves on every babe on the 10th floor, including Amp's own not-too-swift assistant, who'd almost said yes?
"I'm also concerned about Buck's manager," Amp said to the sheriff. "We haven't heard from him in a while. Could your people ask around?"
Sonny Summers said his people were pretty darn busy. Amp suspected they might hunt harder for Kuhlman if Amp offered to further fatten the next bundle of checks for the sheriff's re-election committee. Amp briefly considered making such a proposition, yet he couldn't summon a sense of urgency. The truth was, Kuhlman's absence at Platinum Artists had created no discernible void.
"Never mind," Amp told Sonny Summers. "He'll surface eventually."
"They usually do.
But please let me know if you arrest Mr. Nance before I see it on the news."
"Don't worry. We'll do it low-key," the sheriff said.
"Low-key would be lovely."
Amp said goodbye and speed-dialed Rachel Kuhlman's number. He was free for lunch, and she ate fast. She did everything fast.
Yancey's situation worsened soon after the conk train killing, when Burton reversed field and told him to forget about the Buck Nance case. The sheriff had heard Yancey was poking around and was threatening to leave him on roach patrol for eternity unless he backed off. Yancey accepted the news maturely and went bone fishing until the tide ran out. When he returned, his would-be neighbor, Deb, was sitting on the doorstep. Her nose was elaborately bandaged due to a vaping mishap. After too many cocktails, she'd touched a vintage Ronson to the tip of her e-cig as if it was a Marlboro, sparking a minor detonation. Yancey withheld sympathy due to her sarcastic appraisal of his landscaping. He invited her inside and went to fetch the metal detector. Naturally, that's when Rosa happened to FaceTime him from overseas, Deb answering on his behalf. The two women were having an improbably civil chat when Yancey re-entered the living room. Deb handed him the phone on her way out the door.
"She dropped by often?" Rosa asked, in what Yancey prayed was a teasing tone.
"That's the future next-door neighbor I told you about."
"So, you finally returned her diamond?"
I will.
"Andrew!"
The mackerel dip aged aromatically, so I switched to hummus. He told her of his plan to safekeep the ring until Deb and Brock, the PI lawyer, parted ways, their unbuilt villa a casualty of fractured romance. Rosa said,
"I cannot believe what I'm hearing."
"It'll never last. They're tragically mismatched."
"This is crazy. You're going to get caught."
"Hey, is it snowing over there?"
Days passed before Rosa FaceTimed him again. Against all odds, the call was answered by another unexpected female visitor, a worldly redhead who went by the name of Mary Mansfield. Yancey had met her at the scene of the conk train assault and harmlessly taken her for fried oysters while Burton interviewed her male companion, Buck Nance's manager. Over dinner, Mary had downplayed her relationship with Lane Kuhlman, saying he was a mere diversion from her tedious day job as an appraiser of sunken treasure and maritime artifacts. Yancey found her to be a delightfully entertaining liar, but at the end of the evening he said goodbye with no thought of seeing her again. Yet somehow she'd ferreted out his address and presented herself with no warning. She said Kuhlman had failed to return to the Casa Marina the night Yancey took her out. The man she playfully called Bob was staging a jealous sulk, she said, and not responding to her texts or voicemails. For days, she'd continued to occupy the hotel room until being summoned to the front desk and informed that Platinum Artists was no longer picking up the tab. Would Ms. Mansfield be paying with an Amex, MasterCard, or Visa?
"Bottom line, I've got no place else to go," she said to Yancey after the taxi delivered her to his driveway.
"This is a phenomenally bad idea."
"Where's your spare bedroom, sugar?"
"It's uninhabitable at the moment."
"You've got a couch, right? Don't pretend you're not going to let me in, because we both know you will."
That afternoon, as Yancey stood in the shower, having positioned his phone carefully on the countertop between the floss and toothpaste, Mary breezed into the bathroom and sat down to pee. Moments later, Yancey heard the dreaded chiming of FaceTime and hollered for Mary not to answer. She did anyway.
pawing shampoo suds from his eyes, he flung aside the shower curtain and vaulted, dripping wet, out of the tub. He slipped, no surprise, windmilling through the steam until his forehead smacked the tile. It was his sorry fate not to be knocked unconscious. Mary placed the phone in his fingers, flushed the toilet, and glided out the door. Yancey smiled wanly at Rosa, whose gaze was as frosty as the Oslo twilight.
"Are you naked, Andrew?"
"This is not a date, I swear to God. She just showed up at the door."
"A Jehovah's Witness in a tube top," said Rosa. "What a lucky fellow you are."
"It looks bad, I know. Two calls, two different women pick up my phone, but I haven't laid a lip on any of them."
"Andrew, I'm not mad."
"You should be. I would be."
"I'm just disappointed."
"Christ, that's worse," Yancey said. "Anger cools. Disappointment only festers."
"I've decided to stay abroad a bit longer."
"Aw, don't do this, please."
Thinking, did she really say abroad?
"I want to see more of Norway."
"In the middle of winter, Norway."
"Honestly, I'm not angry," Rosa said.
"But you don't even ski."
"I can take lessons. Hello, I learned to paddleboard in like 5 minutes, remember?"
"Not the same," said Yancey. "Not even close."
"From now on, here's the new rule, okay? You listening? In the future, instead of me calling you, you call me. Preferably when you're not having company."
After the phone went dark, Yancey wrapped a towel around his waist and threw himself on the couch. Mary prepared a bag of ice for his head. She apologized for pissing off his girlfriend. He said she definitely needed to find another place to crash. That night, he grilled bison burgers from Montana. For a beverage, he stuck with iced tea because he knew he'd be driving. Mary was drinking land sharks and getting relaxed. She changed into a Guy Harvey Leaping Marlin t-shirt that she'd found folded inside a drawer, Rosa's Sunday morning wardrobe. When they were done eating, Mary helped clear the table and load the dishwasher. When she asked if Buck Nance had really clobbered that Muslim guy on the conch train, Yancey said he honestly didn't know. He told her he was working on a different case, one that required a different skill set. It was the truth, too. A code red crisis at Clippy's, worse than beard remnants in the quinoa. This one was a bona fide onslaught, a furry monster's ball.
"Why'd you come find me?" he asked Mary.
"Not to have wild upside down in the mirror sex, if that's what you're thinking."
"Tell me your real name."
"The reason I'm here, I had a really good time that night at the Oyster Bar. You made me laugh, and not accidentally, like most guys. How lame is that? Because you're looking at the last girl in the world who should be chasing after a cop."
Yancey said, "I was once a kick-ass detective, that's true, but I've been ingloriously reassigned."
"Because you screwed up, right? There's a shocker."
"Her name was Bonnie, and she was married."
"That's it? Your big slip?"
"Her husband was a doctor, not a good man," Yancey went on. "One day I saw them together and mistakenly thought he was hurting her. I happened to be cleaning my car at the time, so I went after him with my dustbuster. A case could be made that I got carried away. There was a proctological aspect to the encounter."
Mary howled.
"You did it with a vacuum?"
"A cordless 12-volt. This was at Mallory Square with swarms of tourists watching. The doctor pressed charges. I took a plea, lost my badge," said Yancey, "and terminated my torrid affair with Bonnie, who turned out to be a fugitive, by the way, and torched the spec house that once stood right there."
He pointed through a window at the empty lot next door.
She was trying to win me back, which didn't work. Still, I confess, I wasn't sad to see the place go up in flames. It was an abomination.
Mary uncrossed her fine legs.
Andrew, that's a fantastic story on such short notice.
It's all true.
Well, I can't wait to hear about the new job. What is it you do?
Inspect local eateries for evidence of filth, spoilage, and unwanted fauna.
No way, she said.
In fact, I've got to work tonight.
Where? Can I come with?
A fancy joint in Key West, Yancey said, and the answer is a hard no. Put on some underwear. I'll drop you at the Hyatt.
Is it like an emergency?
Moving you to a hotel? Absolutely.
Don't be a smartass. The restaurant call is what I'm talking about.
Depends on your definition of emergency, said Yancey. Does a galloping infestation qualify?
Mary cringed.
You mean like in the Bible?
That would be a pestilence, though you're in the ballpark. Yancey reached beneath the sink and took out a pair of sky blue medical gloves.
Duty calls, darling, he said with the darkest of smiles.
Chapter 11. In the heyday of South Florida's exotic animal trade, niche-seeking entrepreneurs began importing an unusual creature called the giant Gambian pouched rat. In nature, it can be found from Senegal to Mozambique, although, like most rodents, it hardily adapts to any environment. The tropicality of the Keys would prove ideal. Weighing up to 9 pounds, Chrysotomes gambianus is the world's largest rat, a dubious selling point for pet stores. Its body coloration appears dark gray or brown, the belly fur is pale, and the tip of its long tail looks milky white, a trait that breeders hoped would add a cuteness factor. The animal's bat-like ears seem cartoonishly proportioned, while its tapered snout is lushly wreathed with probing whiskers. The term pouched doesn't refer to a kangaroo-style tummy pocket, but rather to grotesque cheek cavities with enough stretching capacity to hold a pork chop. Ravenous ground foragers, the supersized rodents will also scale trees and trellises in search of snacks. They are nocturnal, restless, and perpetually fertile. Not surprisingly, they never caught on as house pets. What limited market there was evaporated completely when U.S. health officials blamed the species for a harrowing outbreak of monkeypox, a fiercely contagious virus. The government reacted by banning importation of the African behemoths, but by then a breeder on Grassy Key had already set free his unwanted collection, which was thriving in the wild. All attempts to extirpate the wily invaders failed. The breathless call from Clippy's came midway through the night's final seating. Tommy Lombardo immediately phoned Yancey and ordered him to get moving.
And no guns, he added.
When Yancey got there, he saw Mayor Neil Gluckman pacing outside the evacuated restaurant. Irv Klapowski stood by the front entrance holding a pitchfork. Meanwhile, a sallow envoy from County Animal Control was examining the broken hinges of a live catch trap that was large enough to hold a full-grown badger. Yancey approached the mayor, who said,
He busted the damn trap. I mean, we had the cocksucker cold.
How the hell did it get out?
The man from Animal Control spoke up.
Brains and brute fucking force, that's how.
He loaded the damaged device into the back of his truck and drove away. Clippy stepped forward, saying,
One of the busboys opened the fire exit. It wasn't his fault, Andrew, and this god-awful monster bolts straight into the dining area.
Which was packed, added Neil.
Neil was there. He saw it all, Clippy said.
Night
mare. Neil closed his eyes. There was an older couple from Brisbane. They called it in as a rabid wallaby. I mean, dear God, they've already posted it on TripSwami. Even though we comped their drinks and dinner. Clippy sighed bitterly. Heartless, Andrew, some people in this world. Yancey felt badly for Clippy and the mayor. Weeks after the initial sighting, not a single pouched rat had been killed or captured on the property. Traditional rodent baits lay untouched in prime corners and crevices. Traps were found sprung or disabled, always empty. Exterminators from as far as Detroit had come and gone, each more vexed than the last. "What did you tell your customers?" Yancey asked. Clippy mumbled at his shoes.
"We said it was a stray cat."
"One of the Hemingway cats," added Neil. "Guys, come on." "You got anything better?" Clippy snapped. "Under pressure, I don't think so."
Neil asserted their patrons never got a clear look at the animal because it was moving too fast. Yancey took the pitchfork from Clippy and said, "All right, open the door." He anticipated this inspection would repeat the pattern of previous visits. There would be clear evidence of occupation by megafauna, gnawed baseboards, shredded bats of insulation, the gambies showing an appetite for R19 fiberglass, territorial urine smears on the PVC, and a daunting abundance of bullet-sized pellets, but no visual confirmation. Yancey had yet to lay eyes on a pouchy, so he was at the mercy of his imagination. In his dreams, the buck-toothed bastards charged at him like bull rhinos. "Could you kill the lights?" he asked Clippy. Gambian pouchies had poor vision, a weakness Yancey aimed to exploit. He'd brought a blinding high-lumen rayovac that in close quarters could double as a bludgeon. Neil jerked a thumb over his shoulder.
"I'll be hanging outside."
Clippy hesitated.
"You go too," Yancey told him. "I'll yell if I need backup."
Unstated among the three men was the fact that a live rat sighting would trigger an emergency closure. Yancey liked Clippy and the mayor, and he had good memories of dining at their place with Rosa. Still, he was bound by the health codes, which said that roaming rodentia of any size were a menace to hygiene. He let his eyes adjust to the dim conditions, then kicked off his shoes and started slowly through the main room. The tables were positioned cozily. Clippy's being a popular joint, every square foot of dining space was utilized. As Yancey advanced, he became aware of the beer cooler's droning hum and his own shallow exhalations. After taking a few steps, he heard scurrying above him. He aimed the beam of the rayovac at the drop ceiling where pocked tiles quivered under the tread of an unseen commuter. Stillness followed, and Yancey moved forward, poking the handle of the pitchfork at random overhead panels. A sharp clatter made him whirl toward the bar, his flashlight fixed on wide-set ember eyes glowing behind a tipped green fifth of Tanqueray. It was a well-fed, fully mature Chrysotomes gambianus, nosing the air and flexing its gin-soaked haunches. Drawing closer, Yancey saw that the tawny trespasser had stuffed its springy cheeks with Neil's special gourmet mix, which featured dwarf almonds imported from Catalonia. Yancey heaved the pitchfork, javelin style, but missed, taking down a row of top-end liquor bottles. The spooked intruder leapt in a full stretch from the bar counter to the wall, where it dangled by two legs from a frame displaying Clippy's treasured 3-star certificate from Michelin. Yancey swung the heavy rayovac, the blunt end cracking the glass, but failing to make contact with the uber vermin, which dropped to the floor, defecated daintily, and dashed away.
"Are you shutting us down?"
Clippy asked wretchedly when Yancey emerged moments later.
"Don't, Andrew, please. Can't you see I'm begging?"
Neil, the mayor, waved both hands.
Stop, Irv. The man's only doing his job. Imagine if it ever got out that we interfered.
I would suggest a voluntary closure, Yancey said hoarsely. Say, for renovations?
Clippy's shoulders drooped.
But it's the height of the season. He's doing us a favor, Neil said. You all right, Andrew? You look shaky.
No, I'm not all right.
How many did you see?
Just the one, said Yancey, but holy fuck.
Were you not able to
kill it?
Yancey shook his head and ripped the gloves from his hands.
Jesus, next we'll be all over Yelp, Clippy groaned. Those bloody Australians. Once we're viral, we're dead. D-E-A-D, it's only a matter of time.
Go get Andrew some water, the mayor said. Clippy made a bit of a scene, backpedaling down the sidewalk.
I'm not going back in there. No freaking way, Neil. Not alone. I'm not.
Yancey said, don't bother. I'll be fine. But fine was the opposite of how he felt on the drive home. He needed a break after his face-off with a pouched fiend, quiet time to steady his nerves and reassess his fast, dwindling role in the universe. Sleep came slowly, but free of dreams. The next morning, he shuffled out of his bedroom and saw that Mary Mansfield had returned. She was wearing camo yoga tights and doing cartwheels on the deck, her long hair whisking the cedar planks like a ginger broom. Instead of running her off, Yancey asked her to ride along while he checked out some funky tattoo parlors in Old Town. She seemed tickled by the invitation. Over the moon, as a matter of fact.
The dog's name is really John?
Martin Trabeau said, I don't see the problem. He's a service companion. The detective said there was absolutely no problem.
What's the nature of your disability, Martin?
Chronic anxiety.
The pickings were lean at the adoption shelter in Rego Park. Trabeau had ended up with a skinny, half-beagle, half-whippet that looked odd in the large orange vest. Since the dog was too young to be neutered, the shelter made Trabeau sign a paper promising to arrange the surgery before the animal reached the age of 2. The Sandman had brought his new companion to the interview at the sheriff's headquarters in Key West, hoping to soften the detective, whose name was Burton.
Tell me about the Buick, he said.
No biggie. It was a hit and run, like I said on the phone.
Trabeau wasn't about to admit what really happened, especially now that he was business partners with Dominic Big Noogie Ayola, the man who'd paid that nutty redhead to crash into him.
Burton said, So you just abandoned the car in the Sears parking lot?
I figured the rental company wouldn't care.
Actually, they did. Why didn't you call the police?
Nobody got hurt, Trabeau said, and I was late for a meeting.
But the Buick was drivable, Burton shrugged. So why'd you ditch it? That's what I'm getting at.
Because I was meeting some important people. It wouldn't look good for me to roll up in some dented piece of crap. That's the reason I parked it and called for a limo.
Trabeau had already explained to the detective that he owned Sedimental Journeys, a leading provider of beach renourishment services.
Describe the vehicle that hit you, Burton went on.
Some old Jap sedan. Toyota, Honda, whatever. I wasn't looking in the rearview when it happened. A loud boom is all I remember. Guy took off right away.
Trabeau couldn't understand why the cops were wasting time investigating a damaged rental car. Who could possibly give a shit? Burton wasn't even taking notes. The dog began loudly lapping its outsized balls.
Stop it, Trabeau snapped. Bad boy!
John II ignored him. The detective said,
When you pulled in at the Sears, did you happen to notice another car like yours?
I wasn't paying attention. All I wanted to do is get off the road as quick as possible.
There was a second Buick with rear-end damage abandoned in the same lot. Pretty damn strange.
What's this all about? Trabeau asked.
Burton showed him a photograph of a shaggy yahoo called Buck Nance, who starred in a cable show that Trabeau had watched only once. The detective asked if he'd seen Nance on the night of the accident.
Is that the moron who hit my car?
He went missing in Key West a couple weeks ago.
Burton handed Trabeau a picture of a younger man with slickened black hair and a studio tan.
That's Lane Coolman, Nance's manager.
Trabeau stated that he'd never laid eyes on either Coolman or Nance. It felt peculiar to be telling the truth. The detective said,
All right, then. Thanks for coming in.
John II had contorted into a writhing ampersand, trying to shed the service vest. Trabeau jerked the dog to its feet.
He's still in training, he said to Burton.
Burton reached down and petted the mutt.
Martin, I was hoping you could give me the name of that limo company, the one that picked you up after the accident.
Trabeau was caught off guard.
I don't think I saved the receipt.
Where are you staying?
At the La Concha.
I'm pretty sure they got phone books in the rooms. Check the yellow pages and see if any of those car services ring a bell.
Do you not believe me? Seriously?
His fake indignation flopped, so Trabeau tacked south.
Okay, what if it wasn't a limousine that picked me up? What if maybe it was a woman? And what if she's married and doesn't want the whole town to know what she's doing while her husband's on a shrimp boat in the middle of the Gulf?
The detective smiled and placed a firm hand on Trabeau's shoulder.
Martin, even if all that was true, hell, if only half of it was half true, I'd still need a name. You understand? Don't leave the island without giving me a call.
When Trabeau stepped from the building, the low rays of the winter sun caught him square in the face. He walked all the way to Louis's, hoping for an open bar stool. A hostess posted in the foyer said he wasn't allowed to bring John II into the restaurant.
But this is a bona fide comfort animal, Trabeau objected.
The young woman came out from behind the podium and dubiously studied the dog.
His vest doesn't even fit. Do you have some documentation?
So, this isn't your first rodeo?
The hostess shook her head.
We get this a lot. It's the new thing.
You know what? Never mind.
There's a 2-for-1 on pina coladas.
Be back in a sec.
Trabeau marched out the front door and down the wooden steps, where he removed the dog's collar and unsnapped the orange vest.
This isn't working out, he said to John II. You're free to go.
Joyously, the mutt galloped off down Waddell, its great ripe balls swinging like Georgia peaches. The romance of Brock Richardson and Deborah had hit a bumpy stretch, due partly to Deborah losing her expensive engagement ring, and partly to Brock's secret experimentation with Petrolux, the same product whose frightful side effects he recited so ominously on television. No one should have known better than Richardson that Petrolux was dangerous, that the male body couldn't safely absorb and metabolize thrice-daily applications of strong deodorizing chemicals juiced with male hormones. Yet, because he merely farmed out product liability cases and had never actually litigated one, Richardson assumed the allegations against Petrolux were hyped, a common tactic in his field. He would have spared himself much misery by studying the victim's sworn statements or just scanning a summary of the expert testimony. But he'd never done that before. Not in the Ambrosia flammable diaper lawsuit, not in the Ram Vigor vitamin contamination case, not even in the Lamb Gland injectables class action. Richardson's only role was to troll for fresh plaintiffs using slick TV spots in which he starred as the pinstriped, doom-faced messenger of gruesome manifestations. The diverse Petrolux litany included excessive hair growth, facial and torso, elongated larynxes, unwanted testicular enlargement, often bilateral, suppurating acne, random tissue deformities, and life-threatening erections, to name a few. Long before the 90 seconds of infomercial horror was over, Richardson's 800 lines would light up. Sympathetic-sounding paralegals would interview the callers, winnow the whack jobs, and hook up the others with a legitimate law practice. When the claims got settled, as such cases usually did, Richardson would receive a very sweet slice of the pie. It was a system that had already made him a multimillionaire. He couldn't remember the last time a live client had walked through his door, and what would be the purpose of such a visit, except for the wall of uncracked legal books that served as the backdrop for Richardson's TV ads, his law office looked more like a Calcutta call center. Over a decade, he'd done so many commercials about so many supposedly harmful pharmaceutical products that he had grown numb to the possibility that some of it might actually be bad shit. He assumed Petrolux was just another worthless dick-stiffening potion that had been carelessly packaged and clumsily marketed. Whose brilliant idea was the juniper fragrance? And all those Texas cheerleaders who tried it, where the hell were Mom and Dad while their medicine cabinets were being pillaged? Concealed in Richardson's suit closet was a 12-pack of Petrolux that had been sent as a TV prop by one of the seven law firms to which he funneled future plaintiffs. One day, he'd curiously opened a box, and thus began a furtive ritual, buttering the sticky purple gel under his arms using the patented Soft Glide applicator. A week later, he awoke with a hard-on that endured 2 cold showers and all 3 hours of the Today Show. He surprised Deb with it when she returned from a pedicure. Afterward, she said the sex was the best she'd ever had. These extended romps continued until, suddenly, late one Sunday afternoon, Richardson was unable to perform. He doubled down on testosterone squirts, and within days he returned to turgid glory. Unfortunately, his bedroom exertions revealed another disconcerting product flaw, namely that Petrolux wasn't a particularly effective deodorant. Worse, the tang of juniper began to overpower not only Richardson's effluvial perspiration, but also other emissions. He shaved off his thickening body hair, yet still he reeked. Soon, Deb declared an end to all intimacies and demanded that he consult a personal groomer. It was at about this time, while visiting their future home site on Big Pine Key, when she dropped the diamond engagement ring, a $200,000 fuck-up that enraged Richardson and temporarily chilled his animal ardor. Still, he continued his covert use of Petrolux, testing different dosages behind locked doors inside his bayfront house on Miami Beach. Manic wanking sessions found him self-gagged with a towel to muffle the deep jungle roars that accompanied every climax. Meanwhile, he and Deb were barely speaking, except for a nightly exchange of barbs on the topic of the missing rock. Richardson saw no choice but to postpone construction of the Keys Villa while the bare lot was searched for the ring. For that important task, he recruited professionals, 3 out-of-work treasure salvers who shared a house trailer on Summerland. So far, they'd spent 100 fruitless man-hours combing the property with metal detectors, shovels, and sifting buckets. Richardson was beginning to wonder if his fiancée had concocted the story about losing the diamond. What if she'd gone and hawked it herself? Maybe she had a drug habit or a gambling problem, or a secret boyfriend with a drug habit and a gambling problem. Richardson's mind squirmed with such ugly doubts while he lathered himself in the shower. He was distracted by a tweak of pain when his loofah snagged on something in the cleft of his left armpit. He explored the site with a forefinger, making a strange discovery. His exclamation was loud enough to echo off the polished walls. Deb entered the bathroom and found him in front of the mirror, naked and wet, one soapy arm held upward.
"What now?" she asked.
"Nothing."
The arm snapped down.
"What were you looking at, Brock? Let me see. Come on, don't be such a baby."
Remembering her uncle was a dermatologist, Richardson lifted his arm. Deb stepped closer and peered at the shorn pit.
"Whoa," she said with a sickly wince. "Not good." "It's just a skin tag. Don't touch it." "Are you serious? You couldn't pay me to touch it."
"I'll get it zapped off at the doctor's. No big deal."
"Jesus, it sort of looks like..."
"I know what it looks like."
Richardson spun away, grabbing for a towel.
"Let me text a picture to Uncle Rob in case it's something serious," Deb said.
"It's nothing, okay?"
Hurriedly, he dried off, bounded across the bedroom, and locked himself in the walk-in closet. There, he took out an unopened dispenser of Petrolux and reread the warning label, which wasn't nearly as frightening as his TV script. In the car, he caught himself steering with his knees while he fingered the pink twig of flesh sprouting beneath his arm. By the time he got to Big Pine, his mood was low, and it didn't improve during his meeting with the treasure hunters. They had failed to recover the $200,000 diamond, but were keen to show him something else they'd unearthed. A molar, they said. Possibly human. Chapter 12. Mary Mansfield told Yancey a version of her life so far-fetched that he bit his lower lip, trying not to laugh.
"That's so rude," she said.
"You've got a charming imagination. I could listen to you go on all day."
"What did I say that you don't believe?"
"Basically every word."
"See, I'm just testing you. So far, so good."
They were waiting outside Tramp City Ink and Piercing for the owner to return from a late lunch. It was the third stop on their tour of tattoo parlors.
"Technically, I'm not a maritime artifacts appraiser," Mary admitted. "Also, I didn't really go to boarding school in Switzerland. My mom wasn't a consular attaché in Morocco. My dad never had a thing with Sigourney Weaver. I wasn't the youngest of six sisters, all master equestrians. I did get married when I was 18, except my husband wasn't pulped to death at an orange juice factory. What really happened, he went to prison for counterfeiting food stamps, and I divorced his ass. No kids from the marriage, thank God, that part's true. What else? Oh, yeah, I didn't lose a $3 million bauxite inheritance to Bernie Madoff. My folks are still alive, and they're not leaving me a nickel."
"So I know who you're not," said Yancey. "Now tell me who you are."
"Aren't you the smooth one?" she laughed.
"Then at least your real name. Come on."
"Mary Mansfield. And even if it wasn't, you're still going to ask me for crazy hot sex."
"I doubt that," Yancey said. "No offense."
"You men, I swear. Look at me."
"I am."
"No, right here."
Mary, pointing two fingers at her eyes.
Now, I dare you to tell me with absolute 1,000% certainty that you're never, ever going to try to get in my pants, that there are no earthly circumstances that would ever put that notion in your head. Let me hear those words. Come on, Andrew.
You know I'm in a relationship.
Just say it. Mary, you're a phenomenally attractive woman, but we are never, ever going to have crazy hot sex. It's totally out of the realm of possibility. No chance whatsoever.
Not on this planet, not in this lifetime, Yancey said. How's that for categorical?
Mary stuck out her tongue. Dick.
That's my point. I'm nothing but trouble.
Me too.
She whacked him on the arm.
Don't you get it?
The answer, again, would be no.
I feel like you're in denial. Something in your voice.
It's called spiritual fatigue. Last night I went one-on-one with a rat the size of a Corvette. This isn't the career I envisioned for myself.
She said, "Know what I'm going to do for you, sugar? I'm going to get a tattoo."
That's flattering and also insane, but we're here on business. The owner of Tramp City was called Wiki, anemic and heavy-lidded. Oddly, he bore no visible body ink or hardware. When Yancey flashed his Roach Patrol ID, Wiki slapped shut a Jack Reacher paperback and said, "What's the problem, man? I run a sanitary premise." Yancey said he wasn't there to do an inspection. "I'm looking for a certain customer."
"Privacy is important to our clientele," said Wiki. "You don't have a warrant. I can't help you."
"Then maybe I'll take a peek at those needles after all. You disinfect them after each tat, right? The machine, no doubt, also spotlessly maintained."
Wiki surrendered in a blink.
"Tell me the dude's name."
"Buck Nance."
"The Bayou brother from TV? I thought he was in treatment after what went down at the Pirate. They said on TMZ he's in Malibu."
Yancey said, "It's possible he's still in Key West. He got rid of his beard, so you might not recognize him."
Mary Mansfield sidled ahead of Yancey and introduced herself.
"Sir, I would very much like to get inked," she said.
Wiki frowned.
"This some kind of trick?"
"I was thinking of a little bumblebee."
"Please don't make a scene," Yancey said to her.
Wiki opened a fat 3-ring binder full of vivid templates.
"You want a standard honeybee or one of the Mexican hybrids?"
"Just a honey, honey."
Mary twirled around and lifted her skirt.
"Right there."
Yancey hustled her outside, stepped back into the shop, and bolted the door behind him. Wiki looked disappointed. Mary waved to him sadly from the other side of the window. When Yancey held up the sketch of a beardless Buck Nance, the tattoo artist shook his head and said,
"I've never seen that guy."
"Maybe he came in on your day off."
"I don't take any days off. Long as the bars on Duval stay open, I'm open."
"So you remember every single tat you've ever done?" Yancey asked.
"Plus, I save all the paperwork for the state, if that's what you mean. I'm strictly legal."
"Ever do one that said, 'Hail Captain Cock'?"
Wiki folded his arms.
"Run that past me again."
"Hail Captain Cock," Yancey repeated. "Capital letters, straight across the shoulder blades. Roman script?"
With a wary nod, Wiki said,
"Yeah, but he wasn't the same dude you showed me in the drawing."
"Then who was it? I'll need the name."
The tattoo man dug through a dented file cabinet until he found it.
"Krill," he said to Yancey, "with a K. First name, Benjamin."
The address was an apartment house on Petronia. Yancey wrote down the number, Unit 277, though he didn't expect to find anybody named Benjamin Krill. More likely, the mystery customer was Buck Nance, giving a fake name and address. Wiki probably hadn't recognized him. A pencil sketch wasn't as reliable as a photograph for ID purposes.
"And you saw this guy when?" Yancey asked.
"The second time was February 4th. See, I got it logged right here. The Captain Cock."
"And the first time he came in?"
"Two nights before."
Wiki had the customer's file in his hands.
"I get lots of repeats because I'm the best in town. It ain't bragging if it's fact."
"What kind of tattoo did you give Mr. Krill on the second?" Yancey asked.
"A badass Chanticleer rooster in profile. Custom job."
"Where?"
"On his stomach. For the bird's eyeball, I inked the dude's navel. He had an innie, so it hurt like a mother. But hey, he asked for it."
Yancey took out his phone and found a publicity shot of Buck Nance on the Bayou Brethren website. Wiki studied the photo, but said he couldn't be sure.
"Every skinny old white fart with one of them ZZ beards looks the same to me."
When Yancey left the shop, Mary called him a prick for locking her out. Then she took his hand and declared there might still be hope. The sensible thing for him to do was say goodbye and walk away. But he didn't. He enjoyed her company. She was a trip. When they got to the apartment building on Petronia, he asked her to wait out front. The door of Unit 277 was opened by a stout woman who could have been 40 or 60. Yancey presented a lightning glimpse of his Roach Patrol credentials, hoping she'd mistake him for a regular detective, which she did. He told her he was looking for Benjamin Krill.
"Nobody calls him that," the woman said. "He ain't here anyhow."
Yancey was surprised to learn that Krill existed. Buck Nance must have known him or at least heard of him in order to use that name at the tattoo shop.
"Are you his wife?" Yancey asked the woman.
"Common law, but not on paper. Let me guess, he ain't paid the damn rent again. Or is it worse than that?"
"What do they call him?"
"I call him Benny, but he goes by Blister. You come to throw his ass in jail?"
In the background, Yancey heard chittering sounds and a blaring television. He asked the woman if he could look around. She yawned and motioned him inside. Dirty laundry was strewn all over the place. The high-pitched barking emanated from a full-grown mongoose leashed on a rope triple-knotted to a leg of the dining table. When the animal spied Yancey, it flattened its ears and lunged wildly on the rope. The woman hurled an ashtray, yelling,
"Shut the fuck up, Cleroy!"
Yancey withdrew straight away. Back in the doorway, the woman said,
"Wouldn't break my heart you had to shoot that thing. Say it got loose and come chasing after you."
Yancey informed her that he didn't have his gun.
"What? Who ever heard of a cop that didn't carry?"
"I'm not here to arrest anybody, Mrs. Krill. This is an administrative visit."
"Oh, well."
She plucked a bent cigarette from the pocket of her housecoat and lit it.
"You can call me Mona."
Yancey said, "I have one more question about your husband."
"No, I don't know where he's at. You find that bastard, tell him to drag his scrawny ass home so I can kick it."
"I was wondering if he's got any tattoos."
"Benny?"
Mona clucked.
"No, sir, and I'd be the best one to know."
She winked and flicked an ash on the floor. When Yancey emerged from the apartment building, Mary Mansfield was thumbing an old newspaper she'd picked up from somebody's front lawn.
"Check this out," she said, and showed him a headline on page 3.
"Electrocution victim identified as Miami ex-con." It was a story about Juan Zeto Fernandez frying himself while recharging his Tesla.
"Did you know this genius?" Yancey asked.
"We were partners, Andrew."
"Oh, this ought to be good," he thought. "Partners in what?"
And, for once, Mary told him the truth. She didn't know what had come over her. Lane Kuhlman was sure nobody had ever been kidnapped twice on the same trip to Key West. In his mind, he was working up an outline for the script, a miniseries for HBO or possibly Netflix. He knew plenty of writers who'd kill for the job. Working title, Hell Island. It was the redhead's fault that he'd been snatched a second time. Had she not pranced off with that sketch cop, Yancey, Kuhlman wouldn't have been walking from the scene of the conch train homicide alone in the dark. He would have been side by side with Mary Mansfield, and the kidnapper likely would have left them alone. It was exponentially way more difficult to abduct two persons at knife point than one. This was a known fact, even among the stupidest criminals. Kuhlman longed to be back in L.A., reclaiming his turf at Platinum Artists and demolishing his future ex-wife in divorce court. Rachel's attorney was probably pitching a fit, complaining that Kuhlman was staying out of California as a stall tactic. Kuhlman wondered what Amp thought about his disappearance, if Amp thought about it at all. The man had the attention span and conscience of a mosquito. Once again, Kuhlman found himself imprisoned on a vessel. Not a lobster boat this time, but a weather-beaten cabin cruiser called Wet Nurse. The kidnapper said the previous owner was a playboy obstetrician. For days, Kuhlman had been shackled to one of four small berths in the bow. After dark, he could see the lights of Key West and sometimes hear applause from the crowds at Mallory Square. During the day, other boats would pass nearby, but he'd given up shouting for help. His asshole kidnapper blasted music 24/7 from portable speakers on the deck, a relentless loop of hard southern rock, Skynyrd, 38 Special, Marshall Tucker, the Allman Brothers. One afternoon, Ramblin' Man played 17 times. Kuhlman kept count. When he pleaded for an updated playlist, his reward was a slap to the back of his head. The kidnapper used an inflatable dinghy to travel back and forth to the island. Kuhlman was given food twice a day, and the menu didn't change. Cheeseburgers, tater tots, and lukewarm lime Gatorade. The narrow berths on the cabin cruiser featured spore-covered mattresses and thin woolen blankets. A plastic bucket served as the toilet. Soapless bathing was permitted on occasion, 30-second dousings from a deck hose spewing seawater. A salty crust had thickened on Kuhlman's skin. His hair was grimy, and his unshaved stubble itched constantly. Early on, he'd tried to initiate a discussion of ransom, but the kidnapper showed no interest. A scornful grunt had been the response when Kuhlman announced he had 21 grand in the bank that he was willing to pay for his release. Still, except for the Ramblin' Man blow-up, the kidnapper didn't seem particularly violent. His knife stayed out of sight, and threats were kept to a minimum. He seldom spoke to Kuhlman and treated him as more or less invisible, which was irritating, though understandable. The man had bigger fish to fry. Some days he'd be gone for a long time, and Kuhlman would bloody himself trying to squirm out of the handcuffs. Unfortunately, it was impossible to lose weight on a cheeseburger and taters diet. If anything, Kuhlman's wrists were getting chubbier. The truth was, he had no willpower. Every time a bag of junk food was placed in front of him, he went at it like a wolf on a fawn. It was a scene that wouldn't appear in Kuhlman's script. To portray him, a hot young actor would be cast, someone who could do stoicism and also drop 30 pounds during the shoot. Kuhlman envisioned Hell Island as a career-saving parachute, in case Amp axed him from Platinum Artists. The money from a miniseries could be semi-decent, especially if Kuhlman started the ball rolling with a best-selling book about his back-to-back hostage ordeals. Hire some slick ghostwriter and spend a week at the W yakking into a tape recorder. How tough could that be? Dwelling on this vainglorious project was mental therapy, for Kuhlman had no logical reason to be upbeat. Mornings on the boat were pierced by the basso horns of cruise ships in the harbor and the high whine of passenger jets on final approach to the airport, melancholy reminders of how close he was to freedom. Whenever the wind clocked out of the north, the temperature plummeted, the old boat pitched, and the windows whistled. Kuhlman had never been an avid sailor, never understood the so-called romance of the high seas. Yachts were tolerable, yachts he could do, but anything under 100 feet, forget it. Although he didn't get seasick, he was miserable in other ways. The kidnapper had thrown his cell phone overboard, a traumatizing blow for any agent. It made Kuhlman feel small and helplessly out of touch with his world. The wet nurse was cramped, rank, gloomy. When the seas got rough, he couldn't fall asleep, unlike the other hostage, who was cuffed to the opposite bunk. The all-night snoring and fart-fest drove Kuhlman batshit, though he didn't complain. The mood down below already was sour and tense.
"You're useless,"
the other captive would bark upon waking.
"You told me about 100 times.
"I'm telling you again. You suck at your job."
"Take it easy."
"No, man, I'm done with you. You are mother fucking fired."
Then Lane Kuhlman would patiently say,
"Chill out, Buck. We're in this together."
Chapter 13. Brock Richardson interrupted with a question.
"What the hell's a Calusa?"
"An extinct Native American tribe,"
the state archaeologist replied. In one hand, he cupped the molar at issue.
"I would say this find dates from about 3,500 B.C.
"Which means?"
"Your property might be an ancient settlement, or even a burial ground."
"Oh, terrific." Richardson wanted to strangle this fucking pinhead, and also the 3 salvers who'd let him on the property.